This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, do you remember the before times? Yeah, me too. Now, is that the economy that we really want to get back to? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today. This one is the 29th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is one of those days where we take the big economic story of the moment and we tell you about it in a couple of different ways. The A-list econ news today, of course, was word this morning from the Commerce Department that January through March of this year, the American economy grew at an annualized rate of 6.4%, the fastest quarterly growth we've seen since Ronald Reagan's first term. But as I believe we've said a time or two on this program, if you just read the headlines, you're missing most of the story. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
We are very close to getting back to pre-pandemic GDP.
Within 1% now. So yeah, pretty close indeed.
Paul Ashworth is chief U.S. economist at Capital Economics. But where we were a year ago is not where we would be now if the pandemic had never happened. But you know what? We're actually pretty close to getting there, too.
We'll probably reach it in the third quarter of this year and beat it in the fourth.
Constance Hunter is chief economist at KPMG. Not only are we getting back to where we would have been, we're going to do about 1.5 percentage points better, she says, by the end of the year. None of this is normal. Recovery from recessions is not usually this fast or this strong.
That does not usually happen, but we also usually do not give this much fiscal assistance and this targeted fiscal assistance.
But you know, all of this stuff, it sounds great. I mean, it is great, but it's not getting Paula Engelking her job back.
I have applied for full-time permanent work and I'm not getting it.
Engelking is 55. She worked in TV production and then writing in the Twin Cities at the beginning of the pandemic. She was laid off in July and hasn't been able to find anything since. And she might just stop looking.
I had friends saying, you know, Paula, you might not be able to get another full-time job.
We're still 8 million jobs short. Restaurants, near office buildings, convention centers, all these things, we don't know what's going to happen with them. Susan Hausman is with the Upjohn Institute.
There's reasons to believe that there will be significant structural change in where we live and how we work.
The economy we get after the pandemic is not the one we had going into it. And that means it will take some time for the human part of the economy to adjust. And that's what you won't see in a GDP number. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
That was a good line, actually, that thing about the human part of this economy not being reflected in GDP, because that's real. All right, anyway, what Sabri was saying makes sense, right? Talking about the economy now versus the economy in the before times, one way to show how we're doing. But consider this for a minute, bigger picture. More than a year into this pandemic, it's getting hard to really clearly remember what the pre-pandemic times looked like. And to the question I started with, is that an economy we necessarily want to work to get back to? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
It's easy to look back at the pre-pandemic economy all starry-eyed. Unemployment was low and pay for low-wage workers was rising.
But I don't want to suggest that that period was a golden era for American workers.
Harry Holzer is a professor of public policy at Georgetown and a former chief economist at the Department of Labor. He says we were making up for decades of job stagnation and loss before we got to relish in a few good years of growth. And that isn't even the benchmark we should use post-pandemic.
Because the labor market would have grown in the interim year to year and a half. So it's more about making up for the jobs, not just that we lost, but that would have been created.
Plus, for certain groups of people, the old normal wasn't so good. Austin Clemens is with the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
we really need to do a better job at thinking about the economy, not as this huge monolith, but as many different households, different levels of earnings, different levels of skills.
Before the pandemic, he says income for high earners rose twice as much as low earners. Black workers were seeing historically low unemployment, but were still almost twice as likely to be jobless as white workers. And lots of people were struggling in ways data didn't catch. Elizabeth Ananot is an economist at Barnard College.
I think that a lot of women are not eager to go back to pretending that they don't have families.
Some women who stopped working to take care of their kids may not go back. Ananot says she'd like to see that become a new major economic indicator, along with food insecurity and unemployment for Black women.
Because when that number goes down, things are going well for everyone.
But for now, a move towards pre-pandemic levels gives us some assurance that the economy is turning a corner. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all sunshine and light. I will tell you what, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. So you probably heard, or definitely heard of, the president's speech last night. Lots in there, of course, policy-wise, as there would obviously be in a $1.8 trillion plan. Two notable line items: free universal preschool and more affordable child care. The average cost of child care nationally in this economy tops $8,000 a year. That is more than in-state tuition for public universities in a whole lot of states. But why? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino broke down the child care costs for us.
Start with the rent. Child care is heavily regulated, and states often have strict requirements for physical spaces, says Shannon Heck with Imprints Cares, a nonprofit in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
It does tell you specifically how much square footage per child you need. Obviously, there are safety considerations, entrance and exits and windows and outlets.
There's also liability insurance and licensing fees. But by far, the biggest cost is labor, almost 80% of Imprints Care's budget, even though,
you know, the average pay for an early child care worker in one of these centers is probably anywhere between $11 and $12 an hour.
The wages are low, but they add up, because on average, facilities need at least one caregiver for every four infants. It might be one to every six toddlers, but Paula Drew, who works with a network of providers in Wisconsin, says even that's hard.
It felt really, really intense to care for six two-year-olds on my own because, you know, they are moving, they are learning to speak, they are learning to potty train, they are learning so much about the world.
The difficulty and importance of the work make it all the more troubling that it's so poorly paid, says Taryn Morrissey at American University.
Child care providers are disproportionately women of color, and they make near poverty wages. Few have health insurance through their employers. Relatively few have other sorts of benefits.
The low wages also mean there's high turnover, which adds costs for recruiting and training new workers more frequently. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We're going to come back now to a story Amy Scott did for us a couple of days ago about reparations, about a church in Baltimore that has promised to spend at least $500,000 to help atone for its role in slavery and segregation and in perpetuating the racism that is systemic in this economy. One key way that racism manifests is in the state of Black home ownership and the state of a lot of predominantly Black neighborhoods in this country. Here's Amy.
Tanika Garibaldi is leading a tour of the 1900 block of Edding Street in West Baltimore.
Welcome. We are standing at the first block of our project.
Tanika is program manager for Black Women Build Baltimore. I'm using her first name because by now we know each other pretty well. I've been following the group for the past year as they rebuild a block of vacant and dilapidated houses. Some of them have been empty for decades. The nonprofit trains Black women in construction skills to help restore houses they'll eventually buy.
So we just finished the three houses that we're standing in front of, and the ladies are securing their loans to purchase the homes.
On the tour are some community development folks, a couple artists, and Reverend Gray Maggiano. He's rector of nearby Memorial Episcopal Church. It just wrote a $15,000 check to Black Women Build as reparations for the church's role in creating the housing conditions here.
To begin to repair and restore the broken bond between this part of Baltimore and Bolton Hill, which is just a few blocks over.
Just a few blocks over, but a world away. The Edding Street houses are in Druid Heights, a historically Black neighborhood where nearly one in three houses is vacant, and the median household income is $21,000. Bolton Hill, where the church is located, is a more affluent, whiter neighborhood by design. In 1910, parishioners helped write the country's first housing segregation law to keep Black people out. And while Bolton Hill prospered, decades of redlining and other racist policies supported by the church hollowed out Druid Heights. Shelley Halstead is executive director of Black Women Build.
You see this neighborhood, and then you go four blocks over, and you see the tree-lined streets. You see the garbage being picked up. You see the houses appreciate. You don't see houses falling in on themselves.
You've probably heard that statistic about the median wealth of white households being 10 times that of Black households. The racial gap in home ownership and home equity have a lot to do with that. Shelley founded Black Women Build to help close that gap. On a recent afternoon, she and Brianna Valines framed a basement window in an old brick row house.
Oh my God, it's perfect.
Brianna is 28 and started working with the group last summer in hopes of buying one of the houses on this block. Shelley hired her to help rehab more of them. They finished four so far.
They're so cute now. Like, it's almost hard to believe, even though I've been here like the whole time and I've been doing it. It's just like, yeah, it looks way better already.
Brianna's house is finished. Now she's working to qualify for a mortgage. Before the reparations plan, Memorial Church raised money for Black Women Build to help with down payments.
A lot of people here in Baltimore aren't homeowners. A lot of people rent. So to give people opportunities to create like generational wealth is a huge thing.
Shelley says the money can only accomplish so much.
I mean, it's never going to be up to the person harmed what needs to happen. It's going to be what people who did the harm can give, right? Not what they should give, what they can.
The church, whose congregation is still mostly white, is working with Black leaders on how to spend the reparations fund. Natalie Conway grew up in West Baltimore and is now deacon at Memorial. Her discovery that her ancestors had been enslaved by the founding rector of the church sparked the reparations effort. She agrees the harm can never be undone.
So you have to think of other ways to repair the breach. Enough is never enough.
But it's a start. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think it's the most efficient way.
Well, yes, efficient perhaps, but best? First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 239 today. That's 0.7%, 34,060. The NASDAQ rose 31 points. That's 0.2%, finished 14,082. S&P 500 up 28.6 tenths%. 42 and 11, a couple of record highs in there, maybe just one, I don't know, but stocks, right? Amazon just reported record results for the first quarter of 2021. Overall revenue hit $108 billion. That's in 3 months. That's like oil company money. Profit more than tripled to over $8 billion over the same period last year. Company stock shot up after hours, as of course it would. Finished the trading day with a modest increase of 0.3%. A lot of the momentum in this economy right now is coming from, well, you and me spending more money as things open up. So let's talk movie theaters, shall we? AMC down 6% today. Cinemark down 0.8%. Cineworld, which is the parent company of Regal Cinemas, down 0.7%. Bonds down as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note up 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The most expensive thing that most Americans buy is a house. And it's the most expensive thing by a lot. So when the market for those very expensive things starts going a little, well, haywire is too strong, but let us say these are interesting times in real estate, you got to check it out. So we have gotten a mortgage broker we know back on the phone. Vivian Geller is the Chief Financial Officer at Pacific Trust Group here in Los Angeles. Vivian, good to have you back on.
Thank you, Kai. Nice to be here.
So do a quick virtual survey for me, if you would, of the offices at Pacific Trust. Are you busy? Are you keeping your heads above water? What's going on?
Yeah, barely keeping our heads above water. Hmm. We thought it was going to slow down by now, but it's just still crazy busy.
Why'd you think it was going to slow down? I mean, mortgage rates are super low, right? There's not a lot of supply of houses on the market, as we've been telling people. You know, you'd have thought that this was going to be sort of boom times for you.
Yeah, I mean, we just thought that based on, you know, all the doom that we experienced last year, that, you know, we would be slowing down at some point because of the, you know, the economy. We thought likely that the economy was going to, you know, decline in some form, but it didn't. And in fact, it's picking up significantly. So we're just keeping really busy. And of course, the, you know, Federal Reserve hasn't increased rates. So we're just slammed with work still.
Yeah. And look, Jay Powell is not going to raise rates for a good long while. So you're going to keep being slammed. But talk to me about brass tacks. What does this mean for if I want to buy in this market? And let's say here, you know, California is a little skewed and especially Southern California. And it's not a market that a lot of people can buy into. But I'm going to ask you to sort of speak to the broader national trend here. Are houses getting snapped up real quick? What's happening out there actually on the ground?
Oh, yeah, they're going incredibly quickly. The market is just so busy with demand, certainly here in Los Angeles, and from what I can tell in other parts of the nation as well. I really think it's the rates that just is keeping everything moving quickly.
Amy Scott, who covers housing for us, did a story a week or so ago maybe about people actually so desperate to get into a house, they're doing things like waiving contingencies. So there's a risky behavior on consumers' part here that they're making to just get into this market.
That's right. In order to, you know, be on the top of the list to have your offer really considered, many people are waiving contingencies, and that includes the loan contingency, appraisal contingency.
Wow.
So basically what you're saying to the seller is that you're going to buy this house no matter what the house value is at. You might be putting down more money if the house doesn't appraise, which is very likely, at least in Los Angeles, to happen.
Do a little compare and contrast for me, would you, between the market now and sort of 15-ish years ago, right before the bust?
Well, you know, it feels similar in terms of the, you know, quantity of transactions we're doing, but it's different in that the loans that we're doing are firm. You know, back then, the loans that were being done were really not quite strong. So I just don't see what happened 15 years ago happening again in terms of the quality of the loans and, you know, just the overall kind of lack of strength that we had back then.
I will take that as reassurance. But let me ask you kind of a bigger question and, you know, draw on your experience in this industry, in this economy for however many years you've been doing it. You know, Case-Shiller came out on Tuesday. It was up 12%. You know, houses are tough to get. It's a huge factor in this economy. Mm-hmm. But what I want to know is, do you think it's a good thing for this economy?
You know, I mean, the economy is just, we know it's going to get stronger, especially through the summer. I think the economy can handle what's going on in the market right now. When rates go up, I think there'll be a natural decline in demand. And I don't see things falling anytime soon. I think that's what's going to happen.
We'll all keep an eye on Jay Powell. Vivian Geller, she's a CFO at Pacific Trust Group here in Los Angeles. Vivian, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. No problem. Take care.
You know who else keeps an eye on Jay Powell? David Brancaccio. That's who. The Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. Everything you need to know to start your business day. You might have seen the other day that President Biden's raising the minimum wage for hundreds of thousands of federal contract workers from $10.95 an hour to $15 next year. That he can just do by executive order. Raising the minimum wage for everybody is going to take Congress to do, which it has refused to do for more than a decade now. Democrats want to basically double it from where it is right now. Republicans and some conservative Democrats, it should be said, say that would hurt the economy. One of you wondered whether there might not be another way to do it that might get actual bipartisan support and make businesses happy all at the same time. With another installment of our series, I've Always Wondered, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Listener Carol Wong of Guilford, Connecticut, sent us this query about the minimum wage conundrum.
Well, if you make the minimum wage $15 an hour, it's not enough in New York and it's way too much in Peoria. I've always wondered, would it be possible to tie the minimum wage to the cost of living, have it vary across the country?
This has been floated in Congress before, and Tulane economist Gary Hoover thinks it's a good idea. He says at $7.25 an hour, the current minimum wage leaves a lot of full-time workers in poverty.
What could happen is every region or even to the state level or maybe some cities index their own minimum wage, putting these people above the poverty level.
He says if we just double the minimum wage to $15 an hour everywhere, that could disrupt labor markets in regions with lower wages. So he suggests raising it modestly, then adjusting to local economic conditions.
We still need to have some type of minimum. What we're trying to do is let the minimum wage float by region of the country.
But wouldn't it be super complicated for employers to deal with multiple minimum wages? Say you're Mike Draper, owner of Raygun, a Midwest clothing chain.
We have stores in Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Kansas City, Chicago, and Omaha.
With minimum wages of $7.25, $10.30, $13.50, and $9 an hour, respectively, set by state and local governments. So, a big pain on payday? Not really.
There's lots of things that vary by state, county, city, so, you know, sales tax rate, minimum wage is just another thing.
Now, in the 1930s, Southern lawmakers pushed the idea of varying the minimum wage to cater to lower-wage regions. And Heidi Sherholtz at the Progressive Economic Policy Institute says it had the same problem back then as it would today.
It would lock in existing low-wage conditions in certain regions that are the result of historic racism.
For instance, in the South.
That would actually result in a higher black-white wage gap because white workers are more concentrated in places with higher wages and black workers are more concentrated in places with lower wages.
Sherholtz says the feds should set a single nationwide minimum wage of at least $15 an hour. Michael Strain at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute thinks that's way too high. But like Sherholtz, he opposes having the federal government set variable minimum wages.
The government of Mississippi probably has a better sense of what makes sense for Mississippi. So why should we have the federal government setting 50 different minimum wages rather than just setting one national wage floor and then letting 50 different state governments decide what to do?
For his part, Mike Draper at Raygun Clothing says he'd be fine with a substantial across-the-board increase.
I would prefer the minimum wage to be higher and uniform around the country just because I think it's the most efficient way to inject some spending power into the U.S. economy.
So more working people could afford to buy more of his products. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Hey, so what do you want to know? Tell us at marketplace.org. We'll see if we can't get it on the show. This final note on the way out today, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the labor market. Talking as we were, Kristen and Sabri, about getting the economy back to wherever it would have been had the past year not happened. First-time claims for unemployment came out this morning. 553,000 people filed the paperwork last week, down from a week earlier, way down from the worst of it, but still way, way higher than normal. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. Comes to us in the form of a report from Oxfam International, a look at women worldwide and this pandemic. We have been talking for a year now about how they've been disproportionately affected. Here's a headline from that report. Women, and again, this is globally, lost $800 billion in income last year. That's wages. And it is more, just for one point of comparison, than the American government spends on defense in a single year. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.